All right, Chicago Stories on WTTW premieres tonight at 8 o'clock. And I'm telling you, this is a really remarkable series. Chicago Stories on WTTW tells an entertaining and intriguing story about a person, industry, or event that shaped Chicago and whose influence still resonates with us today. Anna Gardner is the executive producer behind it all and joins us in studio. Welcome in, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
30 minutes before the debut. We're right there.
Yes.
We're right there.
Very excited.
How long has Chicago Stories been around? Because I knew the days of John Calaway. I knew there was some specials that were sprinkled in here and there. But this essentially is a reboot, right?
Yes, this is a reboot. We are taking stories that may have been told before, but bringing them up to date, you know, putting a more modern spin on them. We have 8 shows that are premiering tonight that we hope you can tune in for.
Now, there was one I saw last year that kind of resonated close to me. It was about the catalogs of Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward, icons of Americana, Christmas catalogs, all this. But it was the rise and fall of these giants that intertwined the history of Chicago and the rest of America. And you think about this, like, they essentially, in the 1800s and 1900s, they created Amazon. What is Amazon today?
Absolutely.
You know?
That was the rise and fall of the mail order giants, Sears and Roebuck and Montgomery Ward. And yes, they were the Amazon of their day. You know, this was mail order catalogs that some of your listeners may remember receiving around Christmas,
yeah.
You know, circling their favorites.
Yeah.
Of course, today, you know, with the click of a button, you can have anything delivered to your door. But this was the original,
yeah.
way to order.
And both in Chicago.
Yes.
And both based in Chicago. I worked for Montgomery Ward the last maybe 4.5, 5 years that they were around. So I was part of the team to revive them. And I'll just tell you the story. We probably had 200 stores by that point. And, you know, we upgraded about 80 of them. They looked like a Nordstrom. So they were beautiful.
Wow.
But then you still had 120 that had duct tape on the carpet and maybe some rat droppings running around. But we really tried to reboot them. And one of the last things I did there is go through the archives. I stayed on a few more months and donate a lot of this to museums throughout the country.
Well, we thank you for that.
Yeah.
Because without those archives,
yeah.
You know, we can't tell these stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, the mail order, you talk about Amazon, how it's done today, the way they were picking was on roller skates,
Absolutely.
You
and we've got some phenomenal images
yeah.
of that. You know,
yeah.
the building was so huge. So to actually yeah. find that piece of inventory
yeah.
and send it out to distribution, yes, there were people on roller skates.
And one of the oldest buildings, the longest one on the river, there's all kinds of mechanicals on the wall by the elevators of what used to run the buildings. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman that actually did that at the end of Montgomery Ward walked in there with me. We met for lunch and he said, I was really actually running the building with all those pieces just about 2-3 years ago.
Wow.
You know? So there was a lot of archiving done there.
That
believe
sure is
me.
Amazing.
Believe me. But this new season, a lot of amazing Chicago stories. And people might know peripherally, like some of the basics of these stories, but you dive really deep.
We do. We dive deep. We have 55 minutes. We are diving into the characters. We bring to light incredible archive, video elements, photo elements. You know, our team sifts for months and months. And oftentimes these are stories that are part of history, but there are new developments. You know, we
right.
can bring it or we can look at them through a new lens. So, yes, there's a lot to dig into.
And tonight is Deadly Alliance, Leopold and Loeb. Talk a little bit about what we'll hear tonight, because this is 100 years old. In 1924, these teens. Go ahead.
Yes, yeah. 100 years ago. This is a crime that continues to just intrigue, fascinate, and horrify all those who learn about it. It was two teens from the Kenwood neighborhood down near University of Chicago. And these teens were had superior intellect. And they decided that because they were so bright, that they wanted to try to commit the perfect crime. And so these two teenagers kidnapped 14-year-old Bobby Franks, brutally murdered him.
Mm-hmm.
And as the
Total.
Show reveals, they did not commit the perfect crime. They did not get away with this.
But the detail on this, again, like, so what goes into a typical episode? I mean, you obviously have a team of people that put all this together, but how far out are you actually researching and putting all this together?
Oh, we're at least a year out.
Okay.
So we are in production on a new season that will air next fall
sure.
already, and then we're pitching for the season beyond that. Once our team actively takes a story, it's about a 9-month full-time job,
wow.
you know, for the producer,
wow.
the associate producer, the archive team. Yes, this is a deep dive into a particular story.
Coming up September 27th, the Black Box Scandal, and this has to do with the White Sox, who aren't doing really well this season.
Yeah, right. And that's a through line. You know, they are not doing too well this season. And and this takes us back to 1919 when they also, you know, they were doing well in terms of their play, but they were not doing too well in terms of their ethics. Right. And yes, this is the iconic story of the White Sox players who decided to fix the World Series, to throw the series, essentially.
They could use that right about now.
Right. Really right. Could. If only that was the explanation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Amusement parks is coming up in October, and I'm telling you, I know this will be a big one, because anytime we talk about, you know, things lost in Chicago as far as things that you grew up with, especially your childhood, amusement parks is at the top of the list. I mean, what do we have? We have Six Flags. We have Santa's Village, which is actually doing extremely well and has been revitalized. But there was a ton of amusement parks. I mean, even before Riverview.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And this is, you're exactly right. People love the nostalgia stories, and this really delivers in that department. You know, Kiddyland, Riverview, White City. Kiddyland is the biggest, I think. I'm sorry, Riverview is the biggest that people will remember.
My parents' generation.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, Belmont and Western. You know, we're talking the heart of the city. Hard to imagine that it was actually a huge amusement park at one point.
And what's really cool about that is a lot of those rides do end up around the country at other amusement parks.
Yes.
That's stunning to me.
It really is. There are auctions, you know, when these amusement parks were folding throughout the Chicagolands, they would, the rides would be auctioned off and they sort of reappear elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
But I mean, they were all over the city. I mean, there were multiple Kiddylands, but the Kiddyland that you were just mentioning that was over in Melrose Park, I mean, that was the one I went at as a kid. I think I went on the fire truck when I was 5 years old to the amusement park. I don't think there was a seatbelt anywhere on the truck.
Right.
You just bounced around down River Road to Riverview. But the iconic rides that are there, and I know the Little Dipper is at Six Flags.
Yes.
Yeah, which is beautiful because they really tell a great story about that there. But I remember going there the day of the auction. I mean, how sad is it? And a lot of these parks disappear because of family divide, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oftentimes they are owned within families and passed down through generations. And as we saw with Riverview, that land, of course, as I mentioned, at Belmont and Western became very, very valuable.
Absolutely.
So it's hard to maintain, you know, family, you know, with money like that on the table.
Yeah.
You know, tensions arise.
Well, like Kiddyland, it was the same, very similar story, is one part of the family owned the property and the other part of the family owned the amusement park. And you know, when Costco's coming around saying, yeah, we want this corner, I mean, you know, they look at the bigger picture, and the money in the amusement park unfortunately goes away.
Absolutely. And it's sad too, because the big amusement park like Six Flags is not accessible to everybody anymore. It's very expensive, and it's further outside of the city. So
it makes Santa's Village so, because it was gone for a little while.
Yes.
And Jason Serpian took it over with his partner, and it's beautiful. He bought back rides. He had to seek around the country where they went. The fire truck that was there was, I think, sold to a bar at some point. And when he said it was reopening, they gave him the truck back.
I love that.
Which is
great.
A lovely
That's
story.
Great. That
lovely
is.
Story. The Young Lords of Lincoln Park.
Yes, this is a story that I would imagine many of your listeners may not know. It's one of those sort of, we have a lot of big name stories this season. This is a little smaller, but it's very important and powerful. This is about the Puerto Rican community that once actually inhabited Lincoln Park. You know, many people looking at Lincoln Park today, looking at the upscale restaurants and shops and high-rise buildings, probably wouldn't know that, you know, in the 50s was the beating heart of the Puerto Rican community. And the Young Lords of Lincoln Park is the story of actually a street gang that turned into a political movement when the Puerto Ricans were being displaced because of urban renewal from these neighborhoods. And a man named Chacha Jimenez stood up and really advocated for fair housing and human rights for that community.
Essentially the first Rainbow Coalition that we know today.
Absolutely. Yeah. So they were essentially the Puerto Rican counterpart to the Black Panther Party. And yes, Fred Hampton and Chacha Jimenez did form a coalition known as the Rainbow Coalition to advocate across racial lines, essentially.
It's got to be fun just actually going back and seeing who you can find that's still around, that actually personally has memories about some of these things, right?
Yes, it is. And that's a really important part of why we're doing this is, you know, there are so many people out there who experienced these huge events firsthand, and we want to capture that. You know, we want to document that before they're gone.
All right, we're talking to Anna Gardner. She's the executive producer of Chicago Stories, which premieres tonight on WTTW, and there's more with her next on 720 WGN.
Dave Pryor, WGN.
All right, we're talking to Anna Gardner. She's the executive producer of WTTW's Chicago Stories. I want to talk about next the making of Playboy, because this film is all about Hugh Hefner. I mean, the 1950s created the Playboy empire. Talk about that.
Yeah, the making of Playboy is fascinating, because I think, you know, Playboy and Hugh Hefner, of course, has been, you know, in the news of recent years for a lot of controversial reasons. But we are looking at the origins of this iconic magazine that pushed boundaries and caused so much controversy. And, you know, this was Hugh Hefner in the 1950s, a very, very conservative era. And here comes Hefner, who decides to push those boundaries and introduce this magazine. And essentially, he wanted to create, you know, an aspirational magazine for the young urban male.
Right.
And, you know, along with the pinup images and the nude women, of course, was also some pretty phenomenal reporting and literature.
Storytelling, absolutely.
Yeah. And that surprises a lot of people. And one thing that I learned about this, the genesis of this magazine that surprised me, was the tie to Marilyn Monroe and how Hugh Hefner was able to find on the west side of Chicago images of Marilyn before she became famous, that she, you know, she had posed under a pseudonym for a pinup calendar.
I don't think she gave permission for that either.
So she made $50 and unfortunately sold, you know, signed off the rights.
Yeah.
And so Hefner bought those images for $500, put her on the cover of his first edition.
Yeah.
Of course, without her knowledge, and then, you know, that made him.
That's absolutely did. But then, you know, you tied into, you know, there's a legacy there, but then you tied it, of course, into the Me Too movement.
Yes.
And when you find out some of the things that were going on behind the scenes, it's tough because it does have a legacy, especially here in Chicago.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, he was under fire by the feminist movement when he was, you know, publishing. But now we are looking at this story through a different lens. And so we do provide some context and some understanding there, which is incredibly important.
Then we pivot later in October to When the West Side Burned. And that's surrounding the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yes. That pivotal event. We look in depth at what happened on the west side of Chicago, a community that knew Dr. Martin Luther King, because 2 years prior to his assassination, he had actually lived in that neighborhood. You know, he was trying to bring the fight for equality north. He was trying to shed a light on the housing inequality in that area. And he moved his family into a dilapidated apartment, you know, doors that didn't lock, bathroom falling apart. His wife and children moved in there with him. And so the community on the west side felt like he was their neighbor.
Right.
You know, he brought so much hope to the region. So when he was assassinated, you know, we really delve into the days surrounding that, when it was just absolute heartbreak and eruption of emotions that led to looting and fires and
uprising.
An uprising.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
You then dive into Al Capone's Bloody Business. And I know, you know, people might think they know enough about it, because even when you refer to Chicago to some people, they talk about Al Capone. It's not in anyone's eyesight really here in Chicago anymore. It's so far behind. But you dig a little deeper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think a lot of tourists think of Al Capone with Chicago. You know,
absolutely,
there's a big business here. But yeah, the Al Capone story, I mean, he became sort of the first celebrity gangster. You know, he knew how to use the media.
Yes.
He dressed with that swagger. He would invite the press along.
He was beloved by the public because of his philanthropy and everything.
He would soup kitchens.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all, let's not be fooled by that, right? He was sort of a master of his own marketing. And then it created this sort of dichotomy where you'd see this person who seemed like a bit of a hero, but really he was, you know, running the outfit. He was running a ruthless mob. And so we really dive into that. And the rise of Al Capone is all due to Prohibition.
Right.
You know, it's due to the years of what they call the beer wars, turf wars over these various gangs who were trying to capitalize on distributing illegal liquor.
And, you know, I just rewatched The Untouchables the other day,
which
I haven't seen in a while. I know it's based on, there's true facts and then there's filmmaking going on there, but it is stunning that he got away really with a lot, because he went to jail for tax evasion for the most part.
The most mundane reason, right? We've got a mob kingpin who ends up going to jail for tax evasion.
Yeah, exactly. And then you celebrate house music, which I think is really cool, because I've known this year is the 40th anniversary of the invention here in Chicago. And this is pretty cool. And you know, Frankie Knuckles was in the front of all of it, wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, house music has gone international. And, you know, EDM, which most people know is a spinoff of house music, But it all started here in Chicago. And, you know, not everybody knows that. So this is a really exciting time to dig into that story. And we really go way, way back to the genesis, you know, starting very, very small, you know, with a community that was really sort of a marginalized community. A lot of the Black Latino gay community essentially created this movement.
It was underground is what they called it forever, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And it, you know, it also disco, you know, the disco demolition was a huge event that really did trigger this genre to evolve. House was sort of a spinoff of disco. And so disco went underground, house music went into, you know, the mainstream.
And you talk to, and this is because it's 40 years old, you can talk to a lot of these producers and some of the DJs and some of the people that were there.
Yes, absolutely. And in addition to that, we're talking to the new generation. You know, we're talking to the new generation of performers who are taking, you know, this Chicago-born genre into the mainstream.
Love that. And you said you're working on it already next year. What are some of the stories? Give us a little tease on some of the things you're working
yes,
on.
Oh, yes. Some really good ones. Yeah. Well, you know, another nostalgia play, we're looking at blizzards. So 79,
Hello.
67,
yeah.
you know, people love their weather stories.
Yeah.
We are looking at the Tylenol murders, which was a pretty shocking story where, you know, an over-the-counter painkiller became a weapon of death. So we've got some really good ones in
the mix
here.
What's freaky about that? Our grandparents kept medication way longer than they should have. And I remember when I was cleaning out my grandparents' house in the 1990s, there was a bottle of Tylenol with like original packaging. I'm like, I'm not taking
toss
this.
That. Yeah, toss that, especially if it was extra strength.
So there's a lot of extras that comes with Chicago Stories that you can get online as well.
Yes, absolutely. If you go to wttw.com/Chicago Stories, you'll find the entire episode in addition to all sorts of incredible web extra content.
It's always a lot of fun to dig a little deeper
online,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, and we prompt you in the show. There's a lot of key areas that we wish we had more time to dig into. The web is where you'll find more of that.
Chicago Stories starts at 8 o'clock tonight. Anna Gardner, thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom next year on 720 WGN.